Welcome to the War Report on Public Education. The future of education is an important concern for our time. Where it's heading, how it's evolving, and the influence corporate America has on its outcome. The War Report on Public Education provides critical news, analysis, and perspectives on the what, why, who, where, when, and how of both the new corporate state elites campaign, the Machiavellian agenda to destroy the nation's public education system, and the rising public resistance movement to defend and defeat this Machiavellian agenda. And now, here is our host, Dr. James Avington Miller, Jr.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to this week's edition of the War Report. We are starting on time. I am in the same place that I usually am at this point. I need 4 hours to do a 55-minute show, so let's get right to it. Okay, the last episode of our Black History Month series. And I picked this one specifically for a purpose. In fact, before we're off the air, I'll tell you how all of the other three episodes and this one come together, what they have in common, what the message that I was trying to convey throughout the series, and et cetera. I'll say that to last. Okay. Did you know that there was such a thing as a black elite back in the slavery days, or particularly right after slavery? Going back to that first episode when I talked about the Angolans, the slaves who were dropped off in Virginia in 1619, and that they were from a tribe or a nation of people who were very modern, very advanced for their time, and all the things that their civilization was structured around that was so much more advanced than in many of the European countries, and how those 20-odd, since we don't know exactly whether or not it was a full complement of 30 Africans that were dropped off, there were 30 that were taken from the slave ship and put on the ship that wound up on the shores of Virginia. But they don't say that it was 30, they just say 20 and odd. But anyway, among that group, as I have said, you've had people who were very knowledgeable, they were very skillful, some of them spoke Spanish as well as their African language, they had education, some had war skills, most of them had agricultural skills that were so much more advanced than the colonists, because the colonists, as I've mentioned before, they came from the city. They didn't know anything about cultivating the land, animals, and et cetera. And that it was the knowledge and experience of those Africans when put to work that helped save the colony and eventually contribute mightily to the colonists and their efforts to survive and to thrive. So you could say that they were maybe elite in that regard, and they were individual elites. Some prospered more than others for that period from 1619 into 1660s, 1670s, and thereafter, when things changed dramatically for the African in the colonies, not only in Virginia, but also Maryland and some of the other colonies. So you could say, yeah, there was a black elite back as far as 1619, 1620. And you can say that there were black individuals who did thrive either as freemen and sometime under slavery itself. But those were individual cases, individual circumstances, and yes, all of the colonies, I'm sure we could find, if the records were kept, that there were some, quote, what would maybe be called elite during whatever period they existed. What we're talking about today is truly, truly a notion of a black elite and all of its connotations. This was a group of men, and I'm going to stress that, men, because you know, women, white, black, whatever, red, didn't have rights. And so it was the men who had rights, white men who had rights up until the end of the Civil War. It was this group of men, some in Washington, D.C. itself, others who would come to Washington as newly elected or appointed legislatures, that formed a group, I'm going to call it a group for now, of men and their wives and others, girlfriends, family members, what have you, into this group of elite. And I'm using the term elite here like it is used when you talk about the power elite. You talk about the financial elite. You talk about the political elite. These men fell into all of those categories across the board. Now, here is something that I didn't get a chance to say when we were together last week and the week before about the role of ideology, the racial ideology that came out of Aristotle and the Greeks and the Romans and then made its way through other European areas or countries and then eventually into the colonies. During the colonial period, from early or late 1600s into the 1700s into 1800s, there were three ideologies that were competing with each other. We know them today as the segregationists, the assimilationists, and the anti-racists. These ideologies and the people who were pushing these ideologies, the segregationists, just as the word is used today, they wanted to separate, quote, the races, and in some cases, they even wanted to pack up black Africans and African Americans and ship them back to Africa or possibly out west. Then you have the assimilationists who were, I guess, akin to the abolitionists. They wanted to allow the African and African American an opportunity to assimilate into whiteness. They believe that racial differences really was not a fixed asset or a detriment, and that if blacks were assimilated into whiteness, they could become like, or I won't say identical, to whiteness. And then there was the anti-racist who was saying that racism in any and all of its form is evil, is bad, do away with it. This is important because the black elite in Washington, and let me tell you who the black elite were before we go too much further here. They would become a social class. Social class in the sense of a black social class, the black, I'll call it the black community of the time, had, as I mentioned, was it last week, when I was talking about, I had an epiphany from when I was 4 or 5 years old, and an adult was visiting our home, and he said, I think it was a man who said, if you're white, you're all right. If you're brown, stick around. If you're black, stand back. Well, the black community had its own class structure. And the black elite saw themselves and wanted to be perceived as upper class black men and women. And they formed this group of like-minded people, like-minded attitudes, values, similar social status, economically, educationally speaking, and you have it. And yes, they were mimicking white America. So, who were they? They were educators, and by that I meant they taught school, they had college education, some of them went to very, quote, good schools, colleges. Of course, they had a good, it wasn't public education per se, but they had a good education through the grades, and many of them became educators, ministers. Ministers have always had a high status both in the black community and the white community. So you had ministers. They, too, would have maybe good education through the grades and or college education. Lawyers, doctors, entrepreneurs, congressional representatives, U.S. senators, and other government officials. These other government officials and congressional representatives and a few black senators, they would come to Washington after being elected or appointed to those positions during the Reconstruction period. And they would come to Washington, and they would become part of, and very important part of, this, I won't say newly forming, but yeah, basically newly forming, formed black elite class. This group, they were 100%, I'm going to say 100%, okay, maybe there are 2-10 people who weren't, but 100% assimilationists, integrationists. They, as if you read our promo, they considered themselves Americans first and people of color second. This is important. Even though they were, quote, second class, well, some of them weren't even, you know, considered human yet, they saw themselves then that they were as American as white Americans, and that they would be the example to white America of what could happen when you treated black people fairly, with justice, equality, freedom, liberation. They were the vanguards. Prior to them becoming a class, a group like that, each of those individuals, in particular the upper echelon of this black elite group, would have been considered during the period before the end of slavery, they would have been considered extraordinary Negroes. I've used that term only the last week or the week before. They would be considered by whites as extraordinary Negroes, meaning that they were not ordinary. They were extraordinary, and that they were maybe some type of anomaly in that they were so extraordinary. And so trotting one individual out that would have extraordinary talent or, quote, intellect or intelligence, skills, was not enough during the 1700s, 1800s to convince white people that blacks were human beings capable of extraordinary accomplishments and et cetera, like back in Africa, which no one seemed to know about the history of Africa in the 1300s or 1400s, going back into 900s, obviously, and then 1000s, and then 1100s, et cetera. The Moors and other groups, that, and Egyptians and others who had advanced civilization. And they didn't see that, they didn't know that, or what have you. So when you trotted out this extraordinary black individual for his or her accomplishment, you were talking about an individual who maybe their genes, maybe their skin color didn't really match blackness, but was more like whiteness, but they were an exception sort of thing. So this group would be considered an extraordinary group of individuals. But they also had the belief that in their numbers and their combined accomplishment, they would serve as proof positive that black people, given freedom, given opportunity, could accomplish on the level of the best and brightest white people. So, this was the group, and you can see later on why this group would be considered a threat to whiteness. And I'm using whiteness in a general term now, white supremacy, white nationalism, white racism, etc. So, you have these people who want to assimilate. They don't want to be segregated. They don't want to be shipped back to Africa. They don't want to leave America because they see themselves as American first and people of color second. And this group, education was a pearl of great pride to these people. They had education. They sent their children to the best schools and colleges. And this, and I'm highlighting this for us because we as educators and parents who have children who we're trying to get the best education possible for, it has been laid on black people that we didn't care about education. And as I have said, year one, year two, that is a complete and total lie. My parents, education was the number one thing in our family. that's why and how I got the education that I did. Education has always been important to the African and the African American in this country. We have always looked at it as our passport into middle class, into respectability, acceptability, and all of those abilities. So this group, and I think it's important for me to drive that point home, they were right there pushing education for themselves, for their children, and that education would be, and here's the bottom line, the great equalizer. You know, education has always been touted as the great equalizer in terms of giving everyone an opportunity at bettering themselves in this country. Now, these people, continuing with, like, who were the black elite? They belonged to exclusive clubs. They cultivated genteel manners. They owned opulent homes. They threw elaborate parties. They dressed in the best of style of the day. And many of them spent their summers in their special enclaves, a special place. And I'll depart for 1 second. In Detroit, and if I don't run out of time, I'll tell you about the Black Elite Detroit, but also in Chicago, there were little places that they would go to and spend their summers. People from the elite, from Black Elite from Chicago would come over. Even, I think, Barbara Lewis, the president of Chicago's Teachers Union, she either has or had a place at this summer place. I remember, 2 years ago, I was going to invite her on the show, and the person that was going to be on the show with her said, no, she can't come because she will be spending her summer, that part of her summer, at this particular place on either Lake Michigan or wherever it is. I never went, so I don't remember exactly where it is. Basically, what I'm trying to say is that this black elite was mimicking white elite of the period, and that was who they were at that particular time. Now, what we have is a situation where after the Civil War, and the federal government took the responsibility of providing a pathway for the 4 million slaves to come into freedom and to be able to take care of themselves and eventually contribute to the prosperity of the nation. The black elite had a foot up, a leg up on the slaves that were newly emancipated, even though some of them were free in various parts of the country. The Civil War and the eventually freeing of the slaves would enhance their status. And you get all these brilliant minds coming to Washington, D.C. They are walking the corridors of power and influence. They are entertaining whites from Congress, from the Senate. They have access to the president. They get appointments, federal positions all across the country. They are the cat's meow after the Civil War and during the Reconstruction period. The period would only last people, scholars, differ in terms of when it, not so much when it started, but when it ended. The conventional wisdom is it's the Reconstruction started 1866 and ended 1871/72, about a 12-year period. Some carry it up to the 1870s, trying to give it more or less a 20-year period. But it was during this period that the black elite was able to wield some power and considerable influence with the federal, the new, let's say, surviving federal government and the new legislatures that were coming to Washington during this period of time. Some of the white legislatures, they would come, they would stay in hotels owned by members of the black elite. They would attend events owned by or given by the black elite. The black elite had access to them. They had access to the black elite. And this group, I'm not just, when I say the white elite, I'm not just talking about the legislatures, but other people of power and influence who were coming to Washington from other parts of the country, they were socializing with the black elite. And I'm going to say on an equal footing, and maybe the white elite didn't see the black elite as the extraordinary Negro, but saw them as individuals who were endowed with the same potential as whites. Whatever the situation was, here's what would come out of this that really made the black elite elite and established them in at least black history. You don't hear much about them outside of black history. But here's what happened. After the Civil War, there were, oh, and by the way, I'm going to say this because I did, I laugh on the third time I say it. You know, Lincoln was a Republican. Lincoln ran, Lincoln is considered the father of, he ran for presidency on Republican ticket, considered the father of the Republican Party. The black elite had an opportunity to mingle, have discourse, socialize with powerful men in both halls of Congress, and particularly the radical Republicans. This is where I laugh. You know, saying radical Republicans, and especially in terms of progressive radical, today it's almost hard to even say the words. But anyway, the influence that the black elite had on the radical Republicans was that the radical white Republicans knew that the newly freed slaves would face insidious racism in the South, and that it was necessary to reform, use that word that they use, reform the South in such a way that it would give protection to the new, would become citizens, former slaves. So what the black elite and their allies in Congress, in the Senate, were able to do, and of course the black members of Congress and the Senate, they pushed to secure rights for former slaves. They would pass a series of progressive laws and amendments that was aimed directly at protecting black rights under federal and constitutional laws. Let me pull back and restate that. Congress and the president would sign into law federal laws that were designed to protect the rights of the newly emancipated slaves, as well as the black free people, and most importantly, they would add amendments to the Constitution, making it part of federal laws. And I'm emphasizing that, and I'll come back a little bit later as to why I'm emphasizing that. What they would do was, during this time of Reconstruction, the 13th Amendment would be passed. The 13th Amendment abolished slavery. They would also enact the Civil Rights Act of 1866. That's a biggie. And they would pass the 14th Amendment, which granted blacks citizenship. We're talking here. They were saying that, ooh, black people are not just 3/5 human. Ooh, if 5/5. And as such, born in America, they are automatically American citizens. And as American citizens, they have the rights that are guaranteed in the federal Constitution. They would then pass another Civil Rights Act, the Civil Rights Act of 1875, which attempted to ban racial discrimination in public places. They would also pass the 15th Amendment, which gave black men the right to vote. That, all of them were huge. The 15th Amendment, to me, was right up there, if not number one, but very close to it. Because what the 15th Amendment would do, that would say that black men could participate in organizing and picking their representatives, sending to Washington, and also they would do this, of course, at the state level, too, and get a chance to participate as free people in a government that prided itself as being a nation of laws. Not ruled by a monarchy, not ruled by the church. It was ruled by individual citizens determining their own government and how they would relate to their government. These would be big. With these laws and amendments, it really, really worked, on paper at least, beautifully for the black community nationally. I said Barbara Lewis, it was Karen Lewis. I'm sorry about that. I don't know how I messed that up. Oh, Barbara Lewis was a singer. My bad. So, we would have this period of 10 to 12 years where the black elite gathered in D.C. and in various states, cities within states around the country, really getting an opportunity to be American citizens, and to show the rest of America that they were worthy of the status. We will see, if I have enough time, how this time period would be repeated. Actually, I will say it right now. You can relate this particular time period to that period from 1619 to 1670, when many of the Africans had freedom, they had rights, they were integrated into the colony, they owned property, they mixed with whites from Europe, they had a status that was equal to and sometimes higher than indentured servants, who were mostly white, not mostly, all white from that period at all. And so that this was huge, and I can't, in my view, stress it enough. And so what would happen to this group? Well, things would begin to change, and it would be, you could call it, the Great Betrayal would take place, just like the great effort to emancipate and to give freedom to blacks, opportunities, and et cetera. That was a great event than the crushing of all of this would be considered the Great Betrayal. And here's how it happened. You know from your history, President Hayes, Rutherford B. Hayes, he was one of the guys who succeeded Lincoln after Lincoln's assassination. There was another gentleman, I think Johnson, and then Hayes. Hayes, in his re-election to the presidency, it was almost a dead draw between him and the Democratic candidate. Three former southern states, Florida, and I can't remember the other two, didn't go solid Democrat. And remember, Democrats of that period, which we would call later Southern Dixiecrats, they were the party of slavery and the maintenance of the racial status quo. Republicans, which, this is all flipped now, but the Republicans were the liberal party, more or less aligned with the abolitionists and the push to assimilate free blacks, assimilate them, keep them in the country. Okay. There was this dead heat. As politicians do, politicians from each party got together, and the three states that hadn't gone with the Democrats, they struck a bargain. They basically said to Hayes that if you will do the following, and I'll enumerate those, we will vote for you, putting you back in the office. He agreed. He was put back in office, and the Great Betrayal started. One of the things that this compromise required was that the federal government will pull back all the federal troops that were occupying the South to guarantee the survival of the newly emancipated slaves and to protect any of those whites who were not supporting the Confederacy. And to leave the South so that the South could govern itself. One thing that the Reconstruction period, in addition to the amendments that I mentioned and the civil rights laws, a very important thing also came about was that federalism was trumped states' rights. We have that now going on where the states would say that they have the right to do X, Y, and Z, and that the federal government does not have the granted powers in the Constitution or federal law to interfere, to intervene in the state under its operation under states' rights. They wanted to roll back federalism, but that didn't happen. What they did get was that former Confederate officials and slave owners would be allowed to return to power. Underline that one. Once this happened, the return of the slave owners and the Confederate government that was in place under Jeff Davis, you can guess what happened. The states quickly started to pass what would be called black codes. Black codes would put voter qualifications up so that even though black men were given the right to vote, the states could set the terms and conditions under which blacks could vote. Such thing as literacy tests, poll tax, and all kinds of qualifications. One of the qualifications that we live under today was that felons, men, women who are convicted of felons, go to prison. In some states, they lose the right to vote for life. This came out of what we call the betrayal. Another thing that came out was sharecropping, a sharecropping system. For those of you who don't know about Southern history, sharecropping was basically another form of slavery. Plantation owners would break up their huge plantations into parcels. Then they would lease these parcels of land to former slaves and equipment, and they would have a company store where the sharecropper could go during the winter and draw down food, whatever they needed, run a tab, more or less. And then during the planting season and the harvesting season, the former slaves would, one, have to give the landowner a percentage of their earnings from their farming. Then they had to pay down their debt to the company's store. And believe me, it was always set so that when you met those two obligations, you had nothing left. And in many cases, you were in the hole. But you would be extended credit again so that you would stay on the farm so that the landowner would reap his profit by taking 50, 60, whatever percentage was from you and from what you owed his company store. This was basically guaranteeing that the former slaves would be slaves again. They would be poor. They would be ignorant. And they would not be able to challenge white supremacy in the new sense of being free, like they were unable to challenge slavery before the Civil War. Another thing came about. A conservative U.S. Supreme Court was put in place, and this court would effectively appeal, for all practical purposes, the 14th and the 15th Amendments, and at least the Civil Rights Act of 1875. This was agreed to by Hayes and those, quote, radical Republicans that do keep him as president. They basically threw the blacks under the bus. And no group of black folks would suffer as much and fall as far and as fast back to the confines of slavery under a different name and the loss of power, influence than the black elite. Makes sense. They were the group that had the most and who had achieved the most. Some of them were the equivalent of today, millionaires. They were wealthy. They had everything going for them. The rug was pulled out from under them. And they would mount an effort to restore the rights of blacks. Certain organizations would come about that would try and, at different state levels, as well as the federal level, to protect the remaining rights of blacks. It didn't happen, as you know. And we would see the appearance of all of the efforts to return blacks to slavery would be put into what would be known as Jim Crow laws, practices, enforcement of inferior class status to black. All of those were put into a thing called Jim Crow. And what would put it all together was the Supreme Court decision in Plessy versus Ferguson that stated that separate but equal was constitutional. It was not violating black rights under the 13th, 14th, 15th Amendment or any of the Civil Rights Act that were passed. This would all come about with, after about 10 to 12 years of a period that many people call the most progressive, liberal progressive period in the 400-year history of America. And if you are any way familiar with what I've been talking about today and the other three episodes, I think you may come to say, yes, never before, never after the Reconstruction have America lived up or come anywhere close to living up to the Constitution of this country. Let me take the last 5 minutes and try and make some connections here. The Civil Rights Movement, 50s and the 60s, some call it the Second Reconstruction, when blacks took to the streets, protesting, demonstrating, demanding their rights, and the rights that came out of that, the enforcement of the 13th, 14th, 15th Amendment, the Civil Rights Act that Johnson signed in the 60s, and we saw blacks repeating the same pattern from the 16th, end of the Civil War, the 1600s, yet blacks becoming mayors of cities, big cities, New York, Los Angeles, Chicago, and other places, New Jersey, and just to name a few. You had black becoming governor. You had more blacks being elected to state houses, federal government. And you would see, just like that period of the Reconstruction after the Civil War, there would be this pushback that I mentioned last week. Every period where blacks have made substantial progress that would threaten white nationalism, if you want to call it white nationalism, white racism, there would be a pushback that would seek to push black people back to where they were in slavery or right after slavery. And what I wanted, how I came about developing the last four shows for Black History Month, I had a theme for this series. And what each of the episodes basically represented a cautionary tale of the rise and fall of black people, be it the elite, the Africans in Virginia from 1619 to the 1660s, 70s, even black studies, the black studies movement, the black student campus movement that led to black studies. There were hundreds of black studies programs put in place. Today, there are fewer black studies programs than at its peak in the 70s, part of the 80s. There's been a continued pushback of dismantling black studies department, dismantling it as a discipline, as I explained what a discipline was, the importance of a discipline and the university structure, pushing black studies into ethnic studies where you have black studies, white studies, Asian studies, women's studies, Hispanic studies in one department, diminishing the influence of individual departments at the university level. There's been just pushback. And I wanted to highlight that even when blacks have gotten into the highest quarters of powers and influence, call it black progress, white resistance has reared its head and has, in many cases, been very successful in pushing back those gains. That was the theme of the last four shows. And you can summarize it as I was trying to highlight the never-ending struggle for black people to gain freedom, liberty, and the right to the pursuit of happiness as Americans in America. I think I got pretty much in, and there was so much more that I wanted to say, I need to say, and that I will say in a different format. But the black elite of today owes its beginnings to the black elite of the period that we've just been talking about. I didn't get a chance to tell you about my introduction and induction into the black elite in Detroit and also in Los Angeles. Maybe at some other time I'll tell you about that. But time is up. Thanks, everyone. Have a good rest of this Sunday, and we'll see you. Next week we'll do our annual assessment evaluation of this past year. And we basically say we're going to go into a fourth year. I guess you can glean that from what I just said. So that will be next week's show. And I'm going to highlight some people, as I always do. I got 2 seconds, but I'm going to highlight some of the people who have helped make the War Report the War Report. Thank you, everyone. See you next week.
Join us again next time as we explore and become aware of the most pressing problem of our time, education, corporate America, and their unholy alliance.
Listen to me.